Welcome to The Color Cast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myers, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist in Los Angeles. And we had a rare opportunity to test Mac Pro. Jason specifically had an opportunity. And from our colorist perspective, we wanted to talk about all the things that have changed, all the things that are new, and things that are going to impact you in your decision. Jason really knocked it out of the park and did a slew of all kinds of different tests. So both me and Juan are just really chomping at the bit to hear everything that Jason has to say about all of his testing and everything that really is going to change. But and whether you should get it or not, really, is the question.
Hey, Jason, do you want to give us like an overview just of like what you were testing and what gear you were testing with?
So essentially what occurred was there's a company, they're a post-production integrator called New Media Hollywood. And when I walked in, they had a new Mac Pro sitting on a table. And I said, oh my gosh. So basically what happened was essentially the six core that I was able to test initially was a stock six core D500 with, I think, 16 gigs of RAM and the 256 gigabyte flash. That was the one I was able to test initially. And then he had been able to put an order in for a 12 core as well. And that arrived about a week later. So essentially I got together with you guys, you know, and Juan, you have your new test, the standard flashlight, which is actually really telling in terms of performance. And then Josh, you know, you and I were chatting about things that an online editor might do. And the thing that was the challenge was just that a lot of people were testing the new Mac Pro, but they really weren't testing it, you know, relative to what colorists and online editors might be working in. So I guess the thought was, let's see what a legacy Mac Pro and the new Mac Pro might do in comparison in Resolve 10. And so that's when this all came about.
Yeah, I want to say, I mean, we'll get more into it, but, you know, I'm seeing some of your stats here, and I'm sure we'll share these on Lift Gamma Gain, and you'll be posting them around. But you've got a really incredibly thorough set of tests. I mean, you're really testing everything under the sun, and I think it doesn't just apply to kind of Resolve specifically, but I think to kind of more, you know, thinking generally, things like Redsyn EX, dealing with these 4K files in a very, very sort of real world scenario. I think it's a really, really interesting set of
and
tests.
Even that it was really interesting to see that there was a marked improvement with Mavericks as well. So I know people may be on the fence whether they should move up to Mavericks, but there's specific things that tested better with Mavericks as well.
To make it easier for people, like, what's the bottom line? What Jason, in your opinion, who should get the new Mac Pro? Which model should they be getting?
Wow, that's a good question. I think that a lot of us made guesses early on. And, you know, I got asked that by Chris at New Media. He basically said, you know, what do you think is the ideal high value new Mac Pro configuration? And so, and, you know, you and I talked about this one too. And I think we kind of agree that value wise, in terms of not just, you know, cranking everything to 11, but actually getting what's a really potent choice would be possibly the 8 core with the D700. Pick the SSD that you need. If 256 is enough, that's fine, like a 512. If you can afford a terabyte, that's fine too. And, you know, go about it in terms of, you know, basing your decision on the CPUs and the GPUs. So the 8-core with the D700 and let's say 32 gigs of RAM, you know, with the idea that if you needed to buy more, you could buy more. That seems to be the pocket. You were thinking that too, right, Juan?
Yeah, I think so. And just to, I mean, just to be clear, your test unfortunately did not include that specific model, because I think you were able to test the 6-core with the D500 and the 12-core with the D700. So you were doing the kind of the mid tier and then the very, very high end, but not the upper middle tier that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think the thing that the reason I'm even bringing that machine up is because when we take a look at the 12-core results, there's a very clear sort of indication that the clock speed of the 12-core doesn't necessarily benefit you as much as having sort of a slightly higher clock speed and fewer cores. So the 12-core is 2.7 gigahertz, the 8-core is 3 gigahertz. And in testing, there were some people that I was talking to before I even touched the machines that noticed with machines that they had had delivered very early. The things like pure CPU tests, like After Effects renders, were actually faster on the 6-core 3.5 gigahertz machine than they were on the 12-core. And so the thing that I'm finding is that if you're looking at, you know, spending that extra, I think it's $3,000 to go from the 8-core to the 12-core, you got to wonder like whether that money is better spent on other things as opposed to a possible sort of benefit that's kind of negligible. Because I think what's going on a little bit is that all applications respond to high clock speed really nicely, but not all of them respond to multiple cores as well. And if you take a look at things like Sapphire, which is very CPU dependent, like OFX plugins, I think you really find a benefit in the high clock speed as opposed to more than, say, 6 cores.
So with the Sapphire test that you did, that was really interesting. Were you basing it on a render time or just playback?
Essentially playback. You know, it was one of about, I guess, 8 tests that I did that was, you know, largely based on 2 things. You know, what's the frame rate of our test project when applying that element? And then what was the CPU load? And so just for clarity, the tests that we ran were the standard R9 candle, which a lot of people are familiar with. Then Juan has come up with a standard flashlight, which is a much more sort of an intense test. Actually, when I was running that one, I could smell the heat from the GPUs as it was playing back. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you base that on. There was a Sapphire OFX test, which was based on 3 plugins with different defaults for the actual settings of each plugin. There was a 4K playback test using 4K ProRes generated from some RED files, which I think a lot of people will find interesting. Spatial noise reduction, which, by the way, just decimates all the machines, at least at 4K. That was a spatial noise reduction at 4K, just brings them all to a halt. A render test, which Josh and I came up with in terms of how fast your renders will be based on a 1-minute ProRes project. As well as a bunch of camera formats, and also RED Debayer, as well as RED GPU and RED CineX. So it's a number of things, and you guys will be able to check it out when we post these online. But I guess one of my big questions is, Juan, you devised the standard flashlight. You know, what were you finding as limitations in the standard candle that you wanted to improve upon?
Yeah, I think, I mean, what I was trying to do was, I think, you know, when the standard candle first came out, I think like it was like the GTX 285 was kind of like the best performing card that you could get. And nowadays, compared to some of the kind of middle tier or even low end cards, that card is sort of, you know, laughable. It's like, you know, we've really come a long way since that. Those early days, I think like 3 years ago.
Yes, so, the early days, 3 years ago.
The early days. So back then, I think you had some a decent amount of kind of differentiation between performance on the sort of the standard candle test. And the standard candle test itself has sort of been revised since then. We've just added more blur nodes. But I wanted to do something that was sort of based on that. So it's really just kind of an evolution of the standard candle test, but was maybe a bit more real world in the type of functions that were being tested, and also much, much more taxing. So one of the things we're doing with that is it comes with a piece of media. So you're actually testing Debayer, not just, you know, playback. And it's a bunch of different types of nodes being affected on the image, not just blur nodes. So it's sort of a stress test on a variety of different levels. And hopefully it creates some differentiation. You know, what I tried to do was kind of have a baseline test that was just basically just playback. You know, is your machine able to play back this data at this rate? So that really is kind of just a very, very straightforward test. That's like half res 4K Debayer and nothing else. And so if your machine's able to play that back, which is pretty low end, like it's basically, it'll play back on like a MacBook Retina. We'll be able to play that test, assuming fast enough piece of media. Then beyond that, you start getting into really, really, really taxing processing, to the point where I think, you know, you're mentioning the smoke coming off the card. I think for some of those tests, you know, I think if you're testing them on a variety of different hardware, you would go like, this is not, you can't really test this. Like, I think, you know, just looking at your stats here, it's like, you know, high performance is like, on some of the tests, it's like 7 frames a second. It's like a very high performance system.
The thing about your test that I think is so great is it actually accounts for things being used in the real world, like how you'd be using it. Because let's be honest, you're not applying for blur nodes at any time ever. Like full screen, full res blurs. It's like, yeah, it's a good test to see how strong it is. But I think that when you have stuff like debayering and playing back 4K, 5K files and all
right,
that, that's like more apt to how you'd be using it. Like I always thought that having those tons of blur nodes in there, it's like, yeah, that's great. You're really pushing the card, but it's, you know, it's not really, it doesn't help you in any other way to understand how it would be used in the real world.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the standard flashlight is a really, really, it's not a lightweight test
right.
at all. It's very, very heavy duty. I mean, you can, just loading up the project, you can feel kind of the weight of it. It's got a, it takes a while to kind of just refresh the GUI, and it's, that was kind of the idea. This wasn't meant to be kind of, you know, oh, look how many nodes we can do of this one function. The idea is, you know, nightmare scenarios.
Right.
How will it perform? And so hopefully it's indicative of that. I mean, I think if you know, just comparing the stats here, Jason, you know, one of the things I'm seeing is like, you know, they line up pretty well with what you're seeing in the standard candle test. Like you're seeing kind of similar results in the standard flashlight. I think it's just a little more kind of differentiation between the platforms.
Yeah, one of the things that was interesting is to, you know, so one standard flashlight starts with a setting called base. And so the machines are like, you know, happily skipping along, and then you put test one light on, it's like, whoa. You know, the machines immediately like plummet. And then, you know, then that's when you start smelling the heat from your computer. And then you hit it again with heavy and it plummets even harder. And I think one of the things that's remarkable is as you move through these different tests, if you take a look at the node tree, you can definitely see the complexity really ramp up. And so the thing that's, you know, I got to give Juan credit for is that when I was trying to figure out a 4K playback test, I was actually sort of inspired by, you know, how Juan had approached it and attempted to do something that was sort of iterative in the same way with the idea of, you know, rather than just stacking up blur nodes in 4K, you know, what can we do? And so in terms of this thought of, you know, how do the new Mac Pros or even the older Mac Pros, you know, play back, say, a 4K ProRes project, it started out with this idea of a simple set of corrections. So like a base node, a highlight key, a shadow key, and a vignette, and then repeating that with the idea that we wanted to see how those machines sort of gracefully descended below real-time playback to understand, you know, where their sort of weakness set in. And one thing I'll say is that the new Mac Pro did well. Both the D500 and the D700, you know, did well, but I don't know if these machines are going to satisfy all the people out there that might be doing quite intense 4K work. At a basic level, the D500 was capable of, what is it, I think 5 nodes of basic correction while maintaining 24 frames a second. Mm-hmm. The D700 machine was able to maintain 24 frames a second with 8 nodes. You know, there are guys posting lots of grades that are comprised of, say, 3, 4, 5 nodes, but I think there are going to be times where people are going to need more than that. So I think one of the big questions the test answered was, you know, where is that cutoff between a person, say, investing in the 12-core, or let's say a D700, I would say is the bigger, a D700 Mac Pro versus having to move on to Windows or a Supermicro Linux box
right.
or something like that.
Yeah. I think so. One thing that sort of jumps out at me here is, you know, just from a colorist perspective, I think when you're in a commercial session type environment, I think that D500, that's where you're going to hit a wall, where it's going to coast along pretty darn well most of the time. And if you're in a low stress, low pressure environment, it's not going to be an issue.
And just to be clear,
but
we're talking about working in 4K, or are we talking about working in HD?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think even in HD where you start doing a lot of noise reduction and things like that, I think maybe you you may start to kind of hit that
right.
hit that or you're doing, you know, like Sapphire effects right. and that kind of stuff.
I mean, I don't think a lot of people are delivering 4K yet. At least, I mean, I'm just speaking from the world that I'm in. It's like 4K delivery is nowhere near being anything yet. So, I mean, if you think about like the Mac Pro in terms of just working in HD, it's probably going to kill in just working in HD if that's what your needs are.
It's I think for commercial sessions, I think you'd still want to have like a D700
right.
type of. I mean, I think it's a question of like how much on demand performance do you need? Because realistically, you know, day to day, you might not need that much. It's in the intense session or when you're trying to get something out very, very quickly that you want that extra kind of level of performance. But I think real world, I think you're going to see a really nice space for people on that, you know, that D8 core D700 configuration is going to be a really, really nice spot for people to kind of get really. The advantage here is not so much that you can get, because if we're comparing the performance of these boxes versus systems that have Cubics and have 3 or 4 GPUs in them, I think the Cubics will still win out.
Mm-hmm.
But what's nice here is this is a box that you can buy one piece of equipment, a single SKU, and you've got a ready-made configuration. You know, it's ready to go.
Right. I mean, Jason, even in terms of other than just testing and stuff like that, were you still, like, really stunned by the size of it? Like, I mean, even if you're thinking about this for on-set use?
Yeah, actually, I think, what I'll tell you is that when you first get the box, it really is small, and actually it was really fun. I was texting with Juan and Josh with you guys when I opened the box up, and Juan was like, you know, give me a a common household item to approximate the size.
Oh yeah.
Which was a fantastic question. And God, you know what I said, that's an amazing idea. And I ran around the building over at New Media looking for something, and you know what I found? And I sent a picture of the guys, a roll of paper towel a little bit shorter is exactly the size, like
it's
a roll of Brawny.
It's pretty spot on. Yeah.
Yeah, it is absolutely. The circumference is dead on, the sort of the volume. And then if you were to make, you know, I think a roller paper towel is going to be a little bit taller when set on end. But yeah, if you want to grab a roller paper towel in your kitchen, remove probably 3 or 4 inches. That's the new Mac Pro. So it's really remarkably and small.
The other thing that I've been hearing too is that they're ultra, ultra silent too, which is like, I mean, in a color bay too, I'm sure that's definitely like a nice thing to have to lose all that dB.
Yeah, it is. It's really quiet. What I'll say is that the D500 was incredibly quiet because it never got overly hot. Even when I was pounding it with, say, you know, Juan, your standard flashlight, or doing, say, R3D debayer testing, the D500 was almost imperceptible the entire time. And I mean within inches of it. You could tell, but I think most room noise is going to be louder. Now, on the other hand, the 12-core D700, when I ran the standard flashlight on that, that actually got a little bit loud. Now, loud relative, it was notable. You could tell. And it actually, the external case got quite warm. So I think that's sort of an interesting thought, is 12 cores with the D700 really is the limit of what you can put in a machine like that.
That's interesting. I mean, do you think like this, because, you know, our configurations now are, at least in kind of in my world, it's, you know, we take the box out of the room. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this changes that? Are you going to be more likely to leave this box in the room?
You could. Yeah. I would say that based on the fact that you're probably going to have the devices you attach to it will be louder than the Mac Pro. So let's say you get, some Thunderbolt array or something to work with your media on a Mac Pro, your Mac Pro is probably going to be the least of your problems. You're going to have some other device that is going to be louder and sort of more unpleasant. And the Mac Pro is going to bring that to light, because in the past, I think a legacy Mac Pro was quiet but did make a whirring noise that would nicely cover up, say, other devices. And I definitely think that anything that is all loud is going to be exposed for it, because there isn't a machine now to take the blame for it. I mean, the other thing too is that the size sort of really does lend itself to being placed almost anywhere. I mean, you could probably get a 27-inch cinema display and put the Mac Pro behind it in the space that you might have between your, say, cinema display and the back of your desk or a back wall. You'll definitely be able to fit a Mac Pro behind a monitor or other piece of gear really easily. The connections, that's going to be interesting. I do think that people are going to have some serious cabling coming out of their Mac Pro, but there's a hope that that could, say, drop behind your desk and go into a rack or a cabinet, or maybe you won't need much. Maybe you'll just need a RAID array and a, let's say, a couple of I/O devices, right. You know, and it won't be too bad.
Right. So, I mean, the other thing is like that everyone always brings up is, okay, well, I can't put PCI cards in it. I can't put drives in it. But, I mean, do you think that the Thunderbolt 2 solves a lot of those questions now? Because you could plug in, you know, like a, what are they called? Ultra Studio? Is that what they're called? Man, they have a lot of names for that
stuff. 4K? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. the Ultra Studio 4K? Yeah. The Ultra Studio, they have the 4K, they have the Ultra Studio Express, and then they even have those little dongles. It's just, you know, SDI and Thunderbolt on the other side. So, I mean...
Yeah, the mini monitor.
Right.
I mean, it's $140 or something.
Yeah, and so,
that's insane.
I mean, okay, so that's one card. Let's say somebody comes to you and says, no, but I'm going to need a Red Rocket. You've done your test that say that the debayering is quite good on all of those other cards if you're doing it through Red Cine X. And even, I guess you're saying that the debayering is still good even in Resolve.
One of the big things, too, is that, you know, that's going to be a big consideration is how are you going to balance a couple major things? What Resolve needs for image processing, what R3Ds or some other intense codec will need for debayering or playback. And then if you're interested in Sapphire, you know, how your Sapphire performance is going to fit in among those things. It's basically, I was kind of joking about it, it's like being between a rock, a hard place, and a wall of spikes. So you're going to need to really take a look at those things. And I think a new Mac Pro really will benefit to a certain degree in the modern age with Resolve 10 and Sapphire and stuff like that from, say, like a Red Rocket X. If you can remove that workload from the Mac Pro, because remember, you can't just stack up GPUs anymore, I think this actually brings the Red Rocket X, not really the original Red Rocket, but the Red Rocket X into being a really useful device to pull away that workload if you're working in Red a lot.
I would just interject that with the Red Rocket X in a Thunderbolt interface, the Thunderbolt interface is the limit, the bottleneck in that configuration. That Red Rocket X will be underperforming in that Thunderbolt through that Thunderbolt interface than it would otherwise be performing. It's nice to have that the upside of having that additional processing, absolutely. But again, this kind of reinforces one of the limits of these things, which is that expandability is limited because of the interface and the lack of PCI cards.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I think one of the things that's going to be a big deal as new Mac Pros get out in the world is people are going to start feeling out, you know, what the good rules of thumb are for, you know, what you need versus, you know, what you can do. And so classically, the Red Rocket, the original Red Rocket, in situations where I was helping people out, would often go in a 4x slot in the legacy Mac Pros, mostly due to the fact that a lot of people were often filling the two 16x slots up with other things.
Sure.
And what I found was that the Red Rocket would work well, except for high bandwidth codecs like DPX. That's
right.
Where you would get suboptimal performance. So my only thought is, I agree with you. I think Thunderbolt is going to limit the Red Rocket. I do believe, though, that it will be enough bandwidth in Thunderbolt 2 to allow a Red Rocket to, say, offload Dragon or Epic debayer for you in a way that is useful.
Well, the Thunderbolt 1 interface, like you couldn't pull 4K at 24 frame a second over that pipe off the old Red Rocket, the original Red Rocket. So the Thunderbolt 1 was limiting the effectiveness of the original Red Rocket. Thunderbolt 2 should have enough bandwidth to support the original Red Rocket, the legacy Red Rocket. But with the Red Rocket X, at going to 5K and 6K, you're going to run into an issue here where the bottleneck is that interface, and pulling that data off of that is going to be, you know, I think it would require actually testing with the card, obviously. But I think if you were comparing side-by-side comparison, a Red Rocket X in a chassis on a PCI bus at 16 lane or 8 lane versus in a Thunderbolt expansion chassis on the new Mac Pro, I think you would see a tremendous hit in performance, because that Red Rocket X can fly through those. You know, it can do 6K at, you know, real time and a little bit faster, actually. And 5K, it can do, you know, even faster than real time. And 4K can do even faster than that. And so I think what you'll see is a performance hit from being in the expansion chassis. But that's the trade-off. I mean, that's part of the deal, right? I think, you know, if you're in a world where doing 4K at 60 frames per second versus 27 frames a second is going to make or break you, you're in the world where that Mac Pro maybe isn't the best choice, where you're looking at, you know, a PC solution or a Supermicro or an HP or something. You're looking for that PCI expansion. Whereas I think for most practical use cases, most people are going to be really, really happy with the Mac Pro.
Yeah, I think that the general gist is that, you know, at least it seemed the notion was the Mac Pro is going to work well for 80% of the people out there. And I think that really sort of has become clear with the tests. I believe there's going to be 20% of the world that will need more or will possibly need something more economical relative to their sort of requirements. And overall, I feel like Apple has packed a lot into this really small form factor, but there's also a portion of me that, you know, wishes it was, let's say, a slightly larger with two PCI 16X slots. I think that would really make for a perfect computer. Something that was as small as possible with two slots would really be nice right now. And I think for the future, the way Apple is going about it is definitely, you know, fairly spot on. But we have this transitional period we're going through where people just still have a lot of hardware that would benefit from a PCIe interface.
Yeah.
And Thunderbolt is being asked for a lot to try to cover that gap in the meantime. And in the future, it's all going to be fabulous and we're all going to be grading in 4K on portable devices, I'm sure. But for right now, there's a lot of infrastructure and a lot of requirements where Thunderbolt's going to be stretched pretty fiercely.
But I mean, for somebody learning or somebody just getting into it, the low-end Mac Pro, to me, makes a lot of sense. It doesn't take that much of an investment to get into it. Like, say you get the low-end Mac Pro, you get a...
The low-end Mac Pro is the D300, right, Jason? Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
So we haven't tested that config. I mean, the baseline config here is the mid-range Mac Pro, which is the $4,000. Still, at $4,000, I think that's a pretty good value. But, you know, for somebody kind of... I think maybe it's more for somebody who's looking to do editorial and, you know, motion graphics and that, and then also wants to be able to do some color. I think that's maybe that's the ticket for them, right? That's like that. That kind of jack of all trades shop. That's, you know, not working in 4K, probably working in HD, probably going to be working in HD for a while, and just wants to be able to do a little bit of everything. This is going to be a nice sweet spot for them because it's not a heavy cost of entry, and they're going to be able to get kind of reliable performance. Right, you're going to be able to do a fair amount reliably on that box. I think the person doing, you know, kind of the heavier level, you know, wanting to do more focused color, but maybe not exclusively color, is going to look at that D700, and that's going to be really appealing. It's got, you know, pretty good performance. It's kind of like having a mini Cubics, yeah. Right? You're not, maybe not a full on Cubics, but like 2/3 of a Cubics. Jason, would you agree that assessment? Or
yeah, I believe
1690.
I would say maybe like one and a half 690s. What do you think?
What we were coming to the consensus on, like, right, Juan, would be that maybe a D500, well, a D700 would probably be a lot like a 780. And I think the actual tests that we did with the legacy Mac Pro proved that, because we were able to test the legacy Mac Pro with a GTX 780, also an AMD card called the R9 280X, which some people know about, but it's fairly new. One of the things that's interesting is that we had some suggestions on Lift Gamma Gain when we were initially posted our D500 benchmarks. And so I was able to find a couple of R9 280Xs, which is the very recent AMD offering. The thing that's kind of remarkable is that when we put those cards into the legacy Mac Pro with 10.9, if you open up Resolve, they showed up as dual D700s. So if you would like to have sort of the same complement of GPU, you know, sort of processing that the D700 Mac Pro has, you can go buy two of these AMD Radeon cards, put them in your legacy Mac Pro. And not only did that make a great comparison for us, it allowed us to actually test, you know, where are the GPUs relative to, say, other cards like the 780, because you could put them in the same chassis. But it also allowed us to test the platforms, which was a great suggestion, between, you know, what does a legacy Mac Pro offer and how is that improved by taking those same GPUs and testing them in the new Mac Pro platform.
So if you have those two GPUs in Mac Pro, does it have any other heat or power issues? Like if you had two double length GPUs in there.
Yeah, and so that's definitely an issue. So one of the things that I did when I was first attempting to create this test is test the machines on their own with no extra accessories. And I know some people were asking, hey, you know, it'd be cool to see a real world example with a RAID array, say like a Thunderbolt Pegasus or something, an Ultra Studio 4K and things like that. And I didn't have the resources or time to sort of iterate it out that far. But what I will say is I did try to get a number of GPUs, test the legacy Mac Pro with those configurations in both 10.8 and 10.9, and then compare them to the D500 and D700 Mac Pro. And that gave us a really clear understanding, you know, of where those machines sort of stood in the food chain. But the one thing is that if you're going to go and put two R9 280Xs into a legacy Mac Pro, you do have a power issue. So there are some GPU power supplies out there that you can get that can fit in an optical bay. You know, maybe some people will take care of it if they are interested in going that far with an external power supply, modify the side door on the Mac Pro. But what was really interesting is that taking and putting two R9 280Xs into a legacy Mac Pro really made it quite capable. And believe it or not, that was the fastest machine in both the standard R9 candle and Juan's standard flashlight, was a legacy Mac Pro with two R9 280Xs and an auxiliary power supply. So for people that would like to enjoy that kind of performance, you can go in for a little over, by I guess, probably $750, get two of the R9s, and you know, I guess a $50 power supply, and have at it. And you can have actually faster performance than the 12-core D700 Mac Pro, believe it or not. So there's a lot to be said for knowing what you want to accomplish, and the fact that even now with the new Mac Pro available, that the legacy Mac Pro still has legs if you want to invest in it. So,
right, and you still have the ability to change those out in the future if you ever wanted to. With the Mac Pro, you're stuck. You're kind of there and that's it.
Yeah, you can't say that for the new Mac Pro. And I think one of the things is you're going to see, you know how they have these, a couple of places have, sites have done these like build your own new Mac Pros, like trying to mimic the new Mac Pro configuration with like commodity PC hardware for Hackintosh. And I think the 280Xs are going to be like the configuration for that from now on. It's like that's your direct comparison. There's your virtual D700 card.
For us, I think that NVIDIA was the only game in town. This actually gives them a little competition, which is great for all of us, too, because if AMD starts upping them and they start getting used in the other Mac Pros, and they can say, well, you can use, you know, we're going to come out with another card that's faster or does this or does that, or this is why you should stick with us. So that's really cool. I mean, it helps everybody.
Speaking of that, really quickly, and Juan, you said you might have some thoughts about this, but one thing that we noticed was that the OpenCL performance is really quite improved in the 10.9 version of OS 10. And when you are actually taking a look at these numbers, you can see an appreciable jump in performance when we're comparing OpenCL in 10.8 versus 10.9. And the other thing, too, is I got to give a lot of credit to the guys at Blackmagic, because Resolve 10 is doing so much better with AMD now than in the past when I had attempted to try Radeon cards in the past. It's really a viable option now in a very honest sense. I mean, you can, I think with 10.9 And with the improvements that Blackmagic has made to Resolve 10, you can look at OpenCL as a real, not limited option that you can choose from and feel like you're getting, you know, the performance for a cost that's, you know, quite a bit less in a lot of cases. I mean, if you take a look at a 780, NVIDIA GTX 780, that's around $500. And then you've got the R9 280X is around 370 or so. There's a real value there for a performance that's very similar between the two cards. That was not the case in the past. If you had ever called, say, Blackmagic support about using an AMD card, you know, their stance was, look, for now, you know, CUDA is where you're going to want to be. That's not the case anymore. And I think the improvements on both the OS side and Resolve side have proven that. And I guess, Juan, there's some actual real changes that have happened to OpenCL in OS 10, you were saying.
Yeah, OpenCL, there's a new version in Mavericks that I think is factoring into a lot of the improvements. One of the things this is actually Apple's development. One of the things they've done is really kind of improve the ability to sort of parallelize and access multiple GPUs with OpenCL instruction sets. So I think that's a big part of the reason why you're seeing that performance jump between 10.8 and 10.9 using the same cards.
Do you know if there's a limit to the number of GPUs that the modern version of OpenCL will address? Is it still...
No, that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know if there is. I believe it's not going to scale particularly well, but you'd have to test that. I do think that there's also so there's a couple of things that are kind of remaining issues, and one of them is addressing larger memory sizes with OpenCL environments. So. I think the places where you're still going to get a major, major advantage in using CUDA cards is dealing with a large number of cards, or dealing with really fast high-end acceleration, and also dealing with things like noise reduction and the optical flow analysis. Like, that stuff takes a lot of video memory. And so in those instances, I think CUDA is still kind of ahead of where OpenCL is, but there's no doubt that OpenCL has improved significantly in Mavericks and also Resolve. The Resolve team has put a lot of effort into better supporting it. I think in large part because of Pro. You know, that was one of the selling points for the new Mac Pro, is that it runs Resolve, you know, 6x faster.
Exactly.
You know? And I think that that's part of the reason why, is because they've taken some pains to kind of optimize for the new Mac Pro, and Apple has taken some pains to improve OpenCL performance.
So, Jason, other than Resolve, were you notice any major improvements in any of the other applications? Like, I know we had talked, you said, oh, yeah, Smoke doesn't even launch, or... Did you see anything improved as far as that stuff goes? Or
yeah, I mean, well, one of the things that I'll say is just in terms of general use, the new Mac Pro boots really, really quickly. Just your first experience with it is going to be probably a 10 or 12 second boot from completely off to at a desktop. In fact, it was so fast that when I turned on the D500 Mac Pro when I first touched it, there was another new media engineer in the room with me, and he thought I'd actually woken it from sleep. And you don't know how remarkable that is until you actually see it. And it is definitely even faster in a lot of ways than SSDs that people might be using. I mean, there is a real benefit to the flash storage in a new Mac Pro. And I think actually, in my mind, that's the most remarkable single feature. That is actually a real innovation that I think everyone is going to copy. And I hope dearly that Apple supplies more than one PCIe card slot for storage on future revisions of the Mac Pro, because we could use two or three of those easily. And that would be fantastic to, say, have one for boot and one for, say, cache. That would be really excellent. And then if you were able to get larger and larger sizes, of course, that would help a lot of people who aren't using massive file sizes. In terms of applications, I tried a number of, for one of the things that's interesting is that Final Cut 7, for what it's worth, boots just fine. It had no problem. I tried Media Composer version 7.0.3. That actually gave me an error. While it did install, but it gave me an error. It said something like audio device not linked. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was some error to suss out there. The other thing is that at this point, I didn't try installing Smoke, but I have heard that Smoke on Mac 2013 doesn't boot either. So I think overall, all the Apple apps, the Adobe apps, and a number of other third-party apps are going to work really well. But there is going to be some catching up, and I think that's largely due in part to two things. One would be Mavericks has a tremendous number of changes under the hood, but also I hear the way that a lot of these apps are going to have to address the dual GPUs in the Mac Pro, it's going to have to be fixed, especially for apps that use OpenGL, like Maya with the Viewport 2.0, which is OpenGL based.
Correct. I think Smoke as well. Yeah, with Smoke as well.
All the previewing of effects and things like that, all the real-time previewing is all OpenGL based. So the thing is that I did some reading about it, and I think there's a lot of good articles out about this stuff right now. But OpenCL natively, within its design, I guess, can address a number of GPUs just based on, you know, sort of, I guess, what a hardware abstraction layer that it uses to touch the hardware. But OpenGL actually needs to access the hardware directly. And if OpenGL applications are going to touch a GPU or say more than one GPU, they actually have to be, you know, recoded in order to do that. And I think that's not actually common. And one of the things people say is, okay, a lot of games are OpenGL based. Why isn't that just fine? Because a lot of people use multiple cards in Crossfire or bind the gaming cards together. One of the things is that that actual function doesn't work in OS X. Apple's not using a Crossfire-like approach inside the new Mac Pro. So
correct. But I do think when you're booted into boot camp on the new Mac Pro, I believe it does show up as a Crossfire device. It's just that OS X is not using it as in a Crossfire mode. Crossfire is AMD's kind of bridging protocol. NVIDIA has one as well. What it does is it kind of syncs up both cards and has them behave as one device to the system and to software, so that you get, you know, you're basically improving the parallelism of those applications, because they're just addressing one actual device, but it's effectively being split up over two. OS X actually doesn't support that at the OS level, so that's not active at all. And the way that OpenGL calls are being implemented has to be different now. That has to be able to address the individual device as opposed to just addressing a general call for an OpenGL,
function. And so that's a classic issue that, you know, Apple hasn't supported that at the OS level. And it's so funny, now they've got a dual GPU machine, you know, as sort of the default, and it's still not being addressed. So it seems like a cruel, cruel world sometimes.
It works fine in Final Cut Pro X.
Yeah.
You know, that works fine. Jason, just one of the appeals of the old Mac Pro is like the expandability. So you can put in multiple drives. You have all these SATA ports. You know, you can add a fiber channel card. You can add a SAS controller. All these things become kind of trickier. So this is now one of the dark sides of the new Mac Pro is, you know, expandability. If the base unit works for you, it's great. You've got a really tiny, tight, compact unit that's going to function really well. But as soon as you start trying to branch out beyond just the core capabilities of the device, you start having to add all these peripherals. You end up with this sort of octopus set of cable technicals and a rat's nest of little devices and power adapters and connections to those devices, kind of extending out of your Mac Pro. Did you, in your tests, did you see that just aesthetically? Were you finding like the cabling was getting messy? The installation was seeming like it was going to be kind of an issue, or did it seem like it just kind of straightened itself out
I even had a really basic setup going, and it started to become a bit of an issue. I had a C hard drive that I had all my test media on. I had that connected, as well as you know, keyboard, mouse, all the monitor connections. I would say that I used up all the USB ports just based on needing them for various things like USB sticks to record all my results on and everything. And it was surprising, A, how quickly you can fill all those ports up, and then B, each Thunderbolt device of any merit is probably also going to have a power, you know, supply of some sort. So you're getting into a really serious wall wart management issue. And then the other thing is that the cables themselves, if they were all identical and all unkinked and perfectly straight, I believe that they would bind together really nicely, but you have these different lengths, different sizes. The fact that when they're sent to you, you know, they sort of are wound up in a way that creates a lot of, you know, just curled cabling everywhere. And, you know, the standardized Thunderbolt cables, I think you'll be able to address those pretty nicely, but everything else is going to be, you know, whatever the manufacturer chooses. And I think there's going to be a really big market in new Mac Pro accessory management that's going to explode. Yeah. And, you know, that's a great new market. You know, that's going to be a cool thing solving those problems for people. But if you're able to, say, take a look at a PCIe chassis, I think that will be a nice way to try to minimize the impact of that, like a Magma chassis or the new Robin, the you know, some of the Sonnet chassis, where you can actually use, you know, some of your PCIe hardware, or just choose PCIe hardware with the idea that if you pop a card into a chassis, you're excluding the requirement of a power connector there. And it's going to add up, you know? So as you accessorize your Mac Pro, really think hard about these things, because I think some people are going to have desks and they're going to be surprised at how rapidly it builds up. Because even in just me, connecting a couple things to do some tests in an external hard drive, it became messy rapidly.
I mean, I can see why, kind of from a support tech side, like why a company like Blackmagic or even other manufacturers and developers would really like this configuration, because it makes it fairly easy for them to just go, just get a new Mac Pro, get this config, and you're pretty much good to go. You know, you might need this peripheral, that peripheral, but the rest is up to you. Whereas before, I think you had the issue of, like, with Resolve, and specifically, it's like, well, what GPU are you using? Okay, well, what you need to use this GPU and this GPU for processing, and you have to put it in a Cubix box, and you have to do this, and you have to do that. It becomes kind of a support nightmare. You know, you're, and then everybody's, of course, trying to kind of cut corners or find ways to sort of make it a little bit more efficient. So, you know, I've got this card already. Let me use this thing. Or I have this expansion chassis. Why can't I use that? Or I have, you know, all these little shortcuts or compromises. And it just makes the whole support much, much more complicated. I think sometimes, in my work, I have to kind of consult with clients on some kind of in-house solution for them. And I think, you know, going forward, I'll just be able to say, here, get the 8-core D700 and call me when you've got it, and we're good to go. Like, it's not a huge shopping list of things you're going to need.
Yeah.
It's a much smaller list.
I hadn't
list.
Thought about it before, but when you normalize everything like that, remote grading becomes more of a realistic possibility to me, because you're what do I need? And because you basically, if I understand correctly, it works best if you have the same config on both sides. But if they could just go to a Mac store in Zurich or something like that and buy it, plug it in, you send them the media, then all of a sudden you're remote grading.
Yep, exactly. And you're doing it with some level of performance that is, you know, fairly good. It's like, it might not be up to what my Linux box is doing, but it's also not going to be a slouch. You know, by and large, you're going to be playing back real time.
Right.
That's not bad.
One of the questions I have is for you, Josh, when you take a look at these numbers and see how they might apply to, say, online editing, you know, and the company that you work at, which has, you know, gosh, what do you have? You have like 50 seats there or something along those lines. You know, how do you think the new Mac Pro, given the performance now, would integrate into a company, you know, like you're at?
Well, as you know, Jason, they're highly entrenched in an Avid workflow. And it's all based on having DX boxes, really, because there's certain things in the DX boxes that will get accelerated. Like you don't have to render as much. There's certain exports that can be accelerated with it, but that requires being able to plug it in directly into a interface into the motherboard. So you can't really. I'm not sure if a DX box will even work with the new Mac Pro, and a lot of places have made very big investments in hardware. I mean, we're talking 40 or 50 DX boxes. So that's kind of a problem. Now, the new version of Media Composer and Symphony, it works with, say, an AGA or a Blackmagic interface card, but that's, you know, for all these places that have already made that investment, that's not really the case. So,
well, I think you guys will be covered because you have the DX boxes are PCIe based, and so they have a PCIe HBA, and I think that would go like in a small like Sonnet Echo. You know, one of the $350 Sonnet Echoes over. Do you think that would work, Juan? Do you think there's a bandwidth issue there, or we'll be okay probably over
No, I think bandwidth-wise, I think you'd be okay. But one thing to note is that just because it's a PCIe card in an HBA, and a Thunderbolt HBA, doesn't mean it'll work.
Right. Yeah. And I've heard kind of like hit or miss with it as well. Like it works and it does. There's actually a branded version of that works for Avid or something. That I've been hearing around. But
there's two factors. So there's one, there's a physical factor, which is, I mean, generally if it's a PCI 2.0 card or above, it's going to be okay. But the card itself needs to physically support hot pluggability in order to work in a Thunderbolt device.
That's right.
And then the driver has to have support for that as well. So that driver support is the tricky part. Avid, I'm sure, will if they don't already have driver support, they'll add it. But if you've got a card from a manufacturer, maybe it's a discontinued card, you may not be able to get driver support for that card. That card may never work in a Thunderbolt chassis.
And so people are going to have to almost do like an audit of their equipment and then go to their vendors and figure out whether they're supported and whether there's a modern option if they're not. You know,
right.
So that'll be the big question for them before pulling the trigger at all. You know,
and it's one of those things where you kind of have to weigh it against the gain. You may not get the same, you know, render for digital cut, but then you may be getting speed improvements in other directions. So it may just balance out.
I think this brings a good point to kind of as a nice conclusion, I think, here, which is that, you know, if you've already got a Cubix expansion chassis and a 2012 core Mac Pro or a 2010 12 core Mac Pro, you're not really going to see a gain with the new Mac Pro. You're going to, in fact, you're likely to see a step back.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
In terms of overall performance. So, I mean, I think the people that this device is going to appeal to are people that maybe are on an iMac right now, or maybe they're using a 2009 Mac Pro and they don't have an expansion chassis, where the issue is, are we going to invest $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 in an expansion chassis in the cards in the chassis, or will we just put that into a new device and you know, maybe spend $7,000 or $6,000 on a new device but get better performance, more kind of forward looking performance. I, from my perspective, I think the one unanswered question here, you know, Jason, you did an amazing job sort of really tackling what's the real world performance. And it's actually, I mean, it's quite good. It's, you know, it's certainly a solid performing device. I don't think it's a compelling device for anybody who's got the Cubix and has the investment in the hardware already, but for somebody looking to make a new purchase, I think it's a really, really, really compelling proposition. The only outlying question is just, what is it going to look like? It looks great today on paper. How is it going to look in a year? How is it going to look in 18 months? How is it going to look in 2 years? Is Apple going to continue to update this thing? If 18 months or 2 years go by and there isn't an update and a revision, you know, those graphics cards are going to start to look really weak, and it's not going to age well in the way that I think the older Mac Pros, the legacy Mac Pros, have aged well because of expandability.
Yeah, I think that people who have current good legacy Mac Pro hardware are really going to have to do some rationalizing to figure out, you know, how spending, say, $10,000 or $8,000 on a new Mac Pro plus all the accessories. I mean, one of the things that people really need to do is not only check the compatibility, but add up all the other things you need. If you want to get a good Thunderbolt RAID array that's capable of similar performance that you might have expected on a SAS array that you were using in the past, as well as, say, like an Ultra Studio 4K, and all the other things you're going to need to flesh out let's say your color station, if you have a current legacy Mac Pro with a Cubix or even just the box by itself with a good RAID array and an interface you like, you can go and you can pop possibly 280X, or if you have the room, you could do two of them and then say a deck link, or maybe two of them in a small NetStore PCIe 4X chassis for your accessory cards. I mean, I think that that's a really potent solution as well. And, you know, when people see these results, they're going to find that, still the 2012 and 2010 Mac Pros have a lot of life left in them. If you're a person that doesn't have a machine at all, or if you're in a situation where your current Mac Pro is quite old and it's just time for you to upgrade and you'd like to move on to the new era, I'd say definitely go for it, especially if you have any kind of portability questions, like you're moving around a lot or you're in a situation where you're very mobile with your work. I think this is going to be a killer machine for DITs and people that are doing, like you guys were saying, remote grading and stuff. So before you pull the trigger, it's not instant awesome. You got to take a hard look at what you've got and what you need to do, and then the clarity will come from figuring that out. But don't just order one of these assuming that it's all going to be fine, because there's definitely a lot of checkpoints before you say yes to one of these things.
Excellent, excellent points.
Well, I mean, Jason, I think you did a fantastic job analyzing this and really evaluating this device. I think there's going to be a lot more to discuss going forward and as things develop. But I think this is a great starting point for figuring out, is this thing right for us? Who's it right for? And what kind of performance can they expect? So thank you for that. Thank you for listening. My name is Juan Salvo. I'm a colorist in New York City. You can find me at juansalvo.com and j_salvo on Twitter.
And I'm Jason Myris. I'm a colorist in Los Angeles. You can find me at Jason Myris on Twitter and also on Lift Gamma Gain.
And I'm Josh Petock, also a colorist in Los Angeles. You could see me on Twitter as at Josh Petock, my website, www.joshpetock.com. And I'm also doing a few tutorials for the guys over at mixinglight.com, too. So you can check those out over there, as well as I have some other tutorials up on Vimeo as well. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you soon.